Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I'm thrilled to talk about a subject that has captured my imagination for the last 10 years or so, but it's never really come up in any kind of detail here on the podcast. Now, in the past, we've certainly talked about different ways to think about our life's journeys. Many of you will know I'm a fan of Fowler when it comes to spiritual journeys, stages of faith, and the different things like that. And, of course, there's lots of developmental theories out there that sort of explain what it is that we are humans, you know, what makes for a healthy human life. There's theories that say you need to perform this task or this task or this task. Everything from just, you know, all the physical tasks and the things that help brains develop and the things that sort of, you know, allow for the different parts of your brains to talk to each other. But then it begins to move into healthy differentiation between you and your parents, you know, stepping into adulthood, you know, instead of just being under somebody else's, you know, thinking patterns or whatnot, you're stepping into owning your own perspectives and things. So there's all those different things going on, and we've talked about them all, but one of the ones that we haven't really put it into conversation with is the hero's journey, which is a term that's been made popular by Joseph Campbell. And basically, the hero's journey is a structure, a kind of pattern that I think all of us recognize as pretty much going on in lots of different parts of our lives at any one time, and yet some of the tasks in which we have the chance to embark on a hero's journey are super, super big and feel really, really daunting. And so it's good to talk about what's going on there and all the different ways that the insights of looking cross-culturally and sort of seeing this pattern go on as a human pattern can really help us. I'm thrilled to bring on a friend who's been on the podcast before. She and I have been friends for a dozen years or so. This is Carolyn Pearson, second time on Mormon Matters. Welcome back, Carolyn.
Oh, well, hi, Dan. Great to be with you again.
We love having you. Would you, I mean, the woman needs no introduction, but would you do it anyway, and especially,
especially
a little bit about the hero's journey and how that connects with something recent in your life?
Sure, yeah. Well, I am just sort of a freelance philosopher is what I am. And I'm a writer. A lot of your listeners would know a number of my things. I want to give the disclaimer that I gave to you, Dan, when you called. I am not a real scholar. I am not even a so-called scholar. I am a wannabe so-called scholar, loving to just mix with those who are much more brilliant and well-read than I am. But I do bring some interesting things to this particular subject in that, well, I sort of fell in love with Joseph Campbell through Bill Moyers when he made
right.
him very popular on PBS a few years ago. And then I found this wonderful book that helped me as a screenwriter called The Writer's Journey by Christopher Vogler that shows so many of our great movies and stories in general as following that path. Well, I'm sure go into that more a little bit later.
Right.
And more recently, last year I put out a very small book called The Hero's Journey of the Gay and Lesbian Mormon, which just when I discovered inside of myself that the path, the difficult path that so many of my gay and lesbian friends had to travel was really so consistent with the hero's journey. I thought, you know, I'd love to give them a better vision of who they are and of the path that they're traveling. And so that's kind of the touchstones that I bring to this, and I'm so glad to be here, Dan.
Well, thrilled to have you, and please, you know, bring up pieces of the book as they kind of march here. We're going to focus on the hero's journey in lots of areas, but mostly I think for Mormons who find themselves at that threshold stage, that feeling the call to adventure, to leave the ordinary world, to move into special world and what might be ahead of them. But there's absolute touchstones in, you know, everything else. And your mention of films and books and things like that. I know our next guest is also really up and interesting on those things. And let me introduce to our listeners for the first time a good fellow by the name of Dave Stacey. Dave, would you introduce yourself?
Thanks, Dan. And I'm very pleased to be on the podcast today. I love what you're doing, and I love the program. My interest in Joseph Campbell is a fascinating one as well. I am an active duty military officer, and I'm working at Army Casualty. And here where I work, some heroes have ended their journey. And sometimes they're in the belly of the whale, depending if they're wounded and they're recovering, or whether they are, you know, the honored fallen among us that help keep America free, help protect the world. And so the Campbell story, the Campbell monomyth, whatever you want to call it, really hits home for me. Like Carol Lynn, I was introduced by Bill Moyers in 1988. Ironically, Joseph Campbell and Bill Moyers filmed that interview, and then, as many of you know, Joseph Campbell passed in 1987, and then that documentary was actually released a year later. So we really get Joseph Campbell at his pinnacle. The accumulation of his experience and knowledge was, you know, delivered to all of us to use throughout our lives. And I really am grateful for what we all have and have experienced through Campbell. And I live it every day, as I'm sure you on your journey and Carolyn on her journey. We're all on that journey at some point.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that. Anything else you wanted to bring up about your background, or should we just dive in?
Yeah, let's just go to the deep water.
Okay, cool. Well, I want to, for those of you who haven't heard of Joseph Campbell, let's do our best, just the three of us, to kick in some ideas on what we know about his background. He was born in 1904, and I believe it was in upstate New York. And, you know, typical upbringing, middle class. His parents were Roman Catholic. He was raised with Roman Catholicism. But in an early stage, one of the things that he talks about a lot is that he went to the Buffalo Bills Wild West show. And, you know, even though that's all structured that the Cowboys are the heroes, he was fascinated by the Native American character there who, he said, had his ear to the ground. He had the bow and the arrow. You know, he wasn't dressed. He seemed like he was more in touch with nature and things like that. And so Campbell, just as a young kid, just started, you know, getting into Native American mythology and yet living out his Catholicism. And there's at one point in his conversation with Moyer there, he talks about, you know, he says, the tendency is when you only know your own myth, you think of it as literal truth or like the facts of the world. This really, really happened. But he says when you do the comparison thing, when you read the myths of other cultures and things like that, then you sort of have that ability to sort of see your own in terms of patterns that match up and things like that. And so, you know, among the many things that he ends up showing us is just this pattern that maybe runs through, you know, Buddha's life, Muhammad's life, Jesus' life, we would go Joseph Smith's life. And then, like Carolyn says, the journey of anybody who does difficult tasks, who goes through these ordeals and comes out with secrets or whatnot, that then they share with their community and, you know, sometimes with positive and most often very painful results. Sometimes, as Emergence says, you know, you bring back this pot of gold, and people don't think of it quite as special as you know it is. But of course, you always do find the people who connect with you and stuff like that. I'm getting away from his life story, but early on, he just had that fascinating juxtaposition, and he said he's read through everything in his school library. They finally let him into the adult section of the town library or the county library, and he just read all through the Native American mythologies and things like that. He ended up going to different colleges. He ended up with a master's degree eventually and things like that, but he was in English. He traveled to Europe for a time. He got interested in Picasso, James Joyce, Finnegan's Wake became a huge touchstone for him, and he got very interested in the work of Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, and Carl Jung and some of his ideas and things will be coming up today. But he was a restless soul. He didn't know what to do. He really thought his call was maybe to do literature, so he wrote a lot of stories. He sold a few and things like that. But ultimately, you know, here's the Depression coming along. The prospects aren't very good. He's not sure what he wants to do for a living and things like that. And he ends up finally just in 1933 got a position in the lit department at Sarah Lawrence College, and he was there for the rest of his professional life. I'm trying to think what else. Dave, I remember when we were pre-chatting, you wanted to really play up the Catholicism as a piece of his life that maybe helped shape some of not only what he says, but the critiques of what we might bring into him.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. And, you know, myself, I grew up Roman Catholic, and I was devoted to the faith for the years that I was affiliated with that church, and I have nothing but good feelings. But I do remember a lot of the things that I was taught, and since now today I'm a Latter-day Saint, I can distinguish between the two faiths very literally. And in a lot of Campbell's work, I hear some of that Catholic background versus just being a plain white sheet of paper and see what I find. There were several places, particularly in the videos as you watch them, where, you know, it just sounds like straight out of the catechism book that every youth in the Catholic Church goes through. And it just caused me to stop and think to remind myself that while I really do buy the pattern that Campbell is teaching and believe it's the underlying purpose and truth, I don't believe all the things that he says. I have to make a judgment on each of the steps along the way and check myself and make sure I like what I'm hearing and that it agrees with what I understand. I wanted to add two other little biographical notes, if I might.
Please.
He really struggled in the 30s during the Depression, you know, unemployed for like 5 years, and he felt that inevitable tug towards academia. And I don't think he really meant to go into academia.
Right, he was worried about it. He says it'll take over my life and I'll be locked into an institutional way of thinking.
You know, in a way, that's a huge plus because, you know, he becomes the part not because he wants to, but because it really is him. You know, he becomes a champion of what an academic ought to be. Really skeptical, looks at things very hard before making an authoritative statement. And I do respect that about him. He says back in early 1930s, like 31, 32, and he's trying to sort this out to himself, and he goes back to the Krishna dictate. Krishna is one of the religious groups from the Far East. And one of their dictates is, the best way to help mankind is to perfect yourself. And I think that thought process affected Campbell, that he knew whatever he did, if he didn't do it right and he didn't do it well, it would mislead people. And so since he was the one that circled that thought process out, I think he adopted that as one of his values. He's going to do good scholarship. He's going to make sound statements that he can back up. He is going to try very hard to be honest and have integrity in the process. And then one other little thought comes out, and that's another man that shaped him was a philosopher by the name of Schopenhauer, S-C-H-O-P-E-N-H-A-U-E-R. Interesting thing about Schopenhauer, you know, he believed that an invisible hand was helping to guide our lives, and that the things that were unfolding in our lives were meant to unfold that way. And when you look back, you see that pattern. You see the unfolding sort of has a purpose behind it. And even in my own affairs, I can look back at my own life and I could say, I thought those events were random, but when I look back, they don't look so random anymore. What I thought was a coincidence probably was not a coincidence. And I believe that had a big impact on Campbell, and he says so in some of his interviews, that he was greatly influenced by Schopenhauer's philosophy. That's what I was thinking to add.
Great. And Carolyn, you seem to me, when you started doing your book, Consider the Butterfly, you've made a similar statement to what Dave just said, when he's talking about Schopenhauer, that they're sort of look at the arc of your life story and you begin to see that there's probably some lessons that are being served up for you at the right time, at the right place, for a full flourishing. Do you want to do anything else on that?
Yes, that if we can get a really good look at our own lives, we might acknowledge that they're written as if they were a good novel, with the theme of our life appearing here in this way, and here in a different way through a different character. But it's exciting to me, the thought that each of our lives is constructed to play out whatever theme our soul may have chosen for this particular leg of our eternal journey. I love that. And yes, when I wrote that book, Consider the Butterfly, the people that I had studied quite a lot and that I quoted somewhat insists that synchronicity, and the word synchronicity was brought to us by Carl Jung. That was Brigham's brother, wasn't it? Anyway, that's where we got that word. But the exciting thing is that we do find patterns everywhere. And in the hero's journey, we see a very large pattern that appears over and over in so many lives. But what I have found is that daily we can notice these patterns, these connections, that one thing just happens to bump up against another and create a pattern or a connection in our mind. And as we study it, that could be very meaningful, like an important dream is meaningful. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I love awesome. The synchronicity aspect of all this.
Awesome. And I'll refer people to your 5-part interview with John DeLynn, because you really do a big, nice job there of talking about you and the missing mother, as you know, and the search for the feminine, and almost just your whole life structured in such a way that this would be a big piece of your calling.
Yeah, 5 hours. That was,
well, you didn't talk 5 hours about that, but during that wonderful interview, seriously, that was a great 5 hours of my life. Plus, I've known you so long, I just.
But wow, honestly, Dan, I can, when I rise up above my life in what I call my spiritual helicopter, I really do see important themes being played out in a way that sometimes mitigates the painful places, because if I acknowledge that they're there for the meaningful development of what I got into this lifetime for, then it helps to release yeah. any resentment that I might have, and I can do more honoring.
Yeah, and that's basically, you know, when somebody says, okay, you're going to talk about the hero's journey today, why? How does it help? That's exactly how it helps.
Mm-hmm.
You
yeah.
know, yeah, because you can see meaning and stuff behind it. Now, Dave, when you talk about the invisible hand or the will or something like that, I just want to be careful that we don't sound like we're super theistic here. I'm pretty sure in Schopenhauer, as well as in Campbell, you don't get a sense of a God or an intelligence doing this directing so much as simply much more like Jungian archetypes, much more like just deep structures of whatever it is that drives human experience, sort of having a wisdom of their own and coming together and kind of driving things. You know, we all associate in our mind with this thing called the ego, and we think of our center of ourselves as this brain part that thinks it's in control and it's interpreting the world and it's doing all this. But he kind of draws a line, you know, between the conscious and the unconscious. And for him, the archetypes are, you know, these deeply embedded energies within the universe that are going to speak up, that they're the things that actually provide the real energy of the world. And so the things that happen in your mind, and often we'll see as we talk about the hero's journey, the very earliest stage of a journey is, okay, I've gotten to the point where my mind is interpreting things, and yet I'm feeling all this missing stuff. I'm not quite connecting. You know, there's this deeper part of me, or I recognize that there's edges where my brain can't go. And all those things coming together are more of like, you know, the bubbling up stuff rather than a divine being and even, you know, a conscious intelligence. I don't know. I'm sure there's ways you can go with Campbell on each one, but I don't get a sense for him that it's God choosing. Carolyn, it's almost more like you are saying, like, you perhaps your own soul, if you had a soul that predated this life, you maybe chose these yourselves.
I hope for that. And in my best fantasies, I do see me sitting down with my spiritual committee before I came to this earth and saying, okay, let's kind of plan this out to get the most out of it. What merit badges, what spiritual merit badges have you already gotten, and what ones are you weak in?
Right.
And for me, it seems that I said, you know, I think I need to go down and work on the theme of valuing femaleness in a world that does not value femaleness.
Wow.
And they said, oh, that's good. So we put into place the obstacle course, which is how we work out these things, and we put into place this and that and this and just the right patriarchy and the right family lineage and the whatever else.
A mother and then that dies when you're young and everything, yeah.
I got this great, this would be too rude. And I said, bring it on, I want to go the distance. Well, we could marry you off to a gay man.
Oh, yeah,
that would destroy the last vestige of good feeling you might have about being a woman. Mm. So as I wrote that, the book that many of the listeners would know, Goodbye, I Love You, I wrote, okay, so here I am. Now, certainly my church, seemingly God, and my husband all prefer men.
Yeah. Wow.
Now that's a pretty strong theme.
Yeah.
But to make connections where I can kind of rise above them and see that they are establishing a lot of meaning for a purpose, that gives me tremendous comfort.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm making it up, but you know, we make up stories to help us get through the night. And whether my truth would be your truth in many of these ways, it doesn't matter. And if my story helps me to make some better sense out of my life and to encourage me in future steps, then it's good. And for me, it's true.
Thank you.
That's awesome. I guess for me, Dan, part of it is I want to know the next step. I have a background of, you know, a litany of fascinating experiences, both good and evil. But I really want to go forward. And I want to know what's next and how I can prepare to meet it. Where's my point on the hero's journey, and what can I anticipate, and how do I prepare for it? And for me, you know, that's opening tomorrow. So when I use the hero's journey and I'm trying to figure out where's my next step, it is very helpful.
Yeah, that's exactly why we're going to articulate this. And like Carolyn says, there's plenty of critics who say this is an imposed order or sensibility. I think Campbell would understand that critique. But, you know, he has this wonderful quote that I just, it's kind of, it's embarrassing. It's in the first chapter, but it's also on the book jacket. You know, so it's like, oh, yeah, I only read the jacket. I did not only read the jacket. But you know, it's basically, he says something like, I think that, you know, he talks about a lot of people are looking for the meaning of life and stuff like that. He goes, no, I don't think we're looking for the meaning of life. What we're seeking is the experience of being alive, so that our life experiences on this purely physical plane will have resonances with our own innermost being and reality, so that we can actually feel the rapture of being alive. And there's something to me where, you know, if somebody wants to say, well, this is purely artificial and things like that, I just have to say, maybe, but yet I'll tell you what, it sure connects what's going on in my life with something deeper. I feel more energized. I feel more oriented. That, you know, if something produces real results, you know, I don't need to argue about its exact origins. I just need to say, man, my life is more vibrant because of this.
Right. And let me just toss in here, if I may, that it may not be also that this hero's journey is one that goes from birth to death, and that we can pinpoint precisely where we are? Because it's like, well, I think there could very well be that general territory, but also probably it's a cyclical kind of thing, and
totally,
a multiple kind of thing, that maybe at the same time we're working on different sorts of aspects that curls back on itself, and that just gradually moves us forward.
I just agree with everything Carolyn just said, and you. Campbell believed in living in the moment and said so many times. And when you look at the hero's journey, you realize each of us have probably started and cycled all the way through and then started again.
Right.
So,
or
you know,
in different parts of our life, we could actually be on several hero's journeys at one time. You know what I mean? In this piece of our life, our professional life, in some ways we're having to slay dragons and, you know, face these kinds of difficulties, and we emerge triumphant, but yet we've yet to go on our spiritual one or our physical trial one or something.
Something that Campbell said really changed my perspective. He said, none of these are facts. You can't go out and prove this. It's a kind of a truth that you got to live. And that people get in trouble when they try to prove these little elements of the hero's journey, because they're exceptionally elusive, and there just isn't any mathematical formula that generates these induced events.
Right.
So, particularly, he was picking on Western society, American culture, when he was saying it. But the minute you go to try to prove the hero's journey and elements of the hero's journey, you're in trouble, because it's a myth that's trying to teach a truth. It's a stop sign on the road. It's not the car stopping. It's just an element. It's a sign that says, you need to do this at this point. It's hard to prove what a stop is until you actually are in a car and you put your foot on the brake and the car stops. So the stop sign is not proof of anything. And that's why these, you know, mythological archetypes and experiences are very hard to prove and quantify and induce on demand. I just can't induce it. I've got to go through the cycle and say, that just happened to me, and I now know it's real.
Yeah, awesome. Well, let's just talk the hero's journey, and we'll just trust that whoever listens, it'll either resonate or it won't resonate. I know the three of us, it's been powerful in our own lives, and it's neat, like you said, to know what's ahead, to see where you've been, to, you know, perhaps interpret certain people came in your life and reframe their purposes and all those different things. And so we're going to be very aware as we go that this is an LDS audience. And so we're going to go ahead and all feel free to bring up LDS touchstones for any of these various stages. I know that we're all planning to do some popular culture, movies, books, things that are out there as well to help illustrate it, as well as we can go to the deeper world traditions and things that Campbell at least drew from in the early going. So if you guys are ready, Dave, I'm just going to turn the time over to you. You mentioned the word monomyth, and I think that that's kind of a nice way to at least get in it. You know, when Campbell calls it a monomyth, I guess he got this from James Joyce, from Finnegan's Wake, but it's a term he used that basically says, you know, there's a thousand different journeys, or every one of us is on our own individual, but there's really just one story that is being acted out. So would you take us into that, and then maybe just begin us on the first few stages of the hero's journey? Now, are you going to follow Vogler like Carolyn does? Carolyn, did you follow Vogler pretty much in your book?
I
the
found
12
that
steps,
very useful.
Was it 12? Yeah.
I found that quite useful.
Yeah.
So
I'm using Smith and Brown, and he's got 17 steps.
Okay, 17 steps for you.
Three main phases, 17 steps.
Okay.
And I don't think they're in that much disagreement, by the way.
Dave, before we like really discuss them, though, do you mind giving us a presentation of just what they are, so that as we go a little bit, and if we begin to discuss or whatever, and we kind of fall out of order or whatever, just as you know, the conversation takes us, so that we at least have this framing kind of to set up to say, this is what you're looking for. This is a pretty typical presentation of the various stages.
And, yeah, I'd like to just go through the steps. The setup, though, is there's really three phases on the hero's journey: the departure, the initiation, and then the return. And within those three phases, there are 17 steps, or I'm following 17 steps. And I would just like to characterize each phase and just say what they are very quickly without any examples. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
For the departure phase, of course, the first thing is the call to adventure, or to call to go on journey, usually brought on by a herald of some kind. They issue the challenge or announce significant change ahead. The next step is pretty common, the refusal to go, the refusal of the call. Number three, a mentor arrives, and sometimes a supernatural device at this point is here. Number four is crossing the first threshold. And number five is often when we cross the first threshold, there is a guardian there. And the guardian provides essential tests to prove a hero's commitment.
Okay.
And that pretty much ties up the departure. We hit a transition point into initiation called the belly of the whale, which, as you already know, that is my favorite step in the process.
Okay.
It's a dark, difficult time. And so number six, belly of the whale. Number seven is the road of trials. Typically, there are tasks to be performed, ordeals. Sometimes our hero might fail at a task, but continue the journey. They're beginning the transformation at this point. Number eight fits in with road of trials because eight has the amulets, the advice, the secret agents, comfort and aid on the journey. Number nine is the arrival of the shapeshifter, usually an individual of unknown loyalties.
Yeah, this is so interesting.
Yeah. Number 10, experience of love. This is the fuel. Got to have the fuel. So always in the middle of initiation, you will always find some form of a love affair or some sort of deep abiding love. Shortly thereafter is a trickster. Somebody is there to mislead our hero. Then a tempter, number 12, is the tempter or temptress, as the case may be, to lure them off the path. Number 13 is, again, one of the most important stages or steps in the whole process where you must enter the cave and confront the thing that you fear the most. So that's where the confrontation takes place, where the hero must face his fear. Number 14 is it could be the death of the individual, or certainly is the death of the ego, the childish ego that started the whole process out. Most of us don't die in our journey, but we grow up.
Okay.
And so death of the person, death of the ego. And then from death, we start the return process. And that's the third phase. In the third phase, you know, our hero has received the boon or the elixir of life. Often the elixir, you know, we think of healing. Or a heavenly balm, the Holy Grail. The whole purpose of the journey was to gain the boon, and now we have it.
Okay.
Number 16 is the hero's return. Frequently there's a flight. It could be magical, or it could be rescued from without. But the flight, the return to normal life must occur. And then at 17, we have mastery of both worlds. He's returned to his own world, or she's returned to her own world. They're competent. They're capable, but they no longer fear death. They have survived it. So those are the 17 steps fit in around the three phases.
Okay, and just a little bit more on the framing. Not every hero's journey will have every one of these, but this is like a survey of all these mythic hero's journey things that pretty much you get most of them, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And you can find yourself someplace on this pattern, too.
Right. And
to some degree or other, you'll find most of these types of characters and experiences.
Right. And then the other thing is, so this is from mythic literature and things like this, but the Campbell's main point is it's almost like this at some point in our lives, and often multiple points in our lives, and almost like every year or every sort of, you know, just transition in our life, we're called to go on these hero's journeys within our own hearts. And so we don't need to necessarily throw all this out because there's magic amulets and things in the mythology. There's real world connections that we can kind of discuss, that don't deal with magical creatures and
all that. Absolutely. Yeah. Sometimes those are just representations.
Yeah.
My computer's magic.
That's
right. My smartphone is very magical. You talk about your magic amulet. Seeing a doctor and getting medication, I mean, that I don't know how that works half the time.
Yeah.
And so I want to be careful to say, yes, you know, these are representations of other things that are really, truly happening in the real world. You know, there's not a cave, but, you know, me going down there and telling my boss bad news and facing the risk that he's going to take it out on me, that's real. And he doesn't work in a cave. He works in the corner office with all the windows.
Mm-hmm.
So, So, representations are something to just help frame the argument. It doesn't have to be, you can connect the dots if you want to take the time to do so.
Right. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. With that as just a, like a bare bones, here it is, lay it out there. Now we can get more complicated. So, Dave, if you don't mind, again, just taking the lead, but this time jump in with extra examples, reflections. Let's critique it. Let's pull apart the various stages as we do. Carolyn, of course, please jump in. I feel bad having Dave take the lead, but that's kind of how we tasked it out ahead of time. So please just jump in when we can.
Let me just make a pre-statement that Carl Jung talked about archetypes. These are like personality types that fit a certain pattern or expectation. You know, like you keep saying the word hero, but there's some other archetypes, scapegoat, perhaps mentor. And, you know, throughout the different stages and phases of the hero's journey, these characters come and go, and they have their little part to play in the hero's journey. And so throughout the structure that I'm going to talk about here for a second, you're going to see that these archetypes are essential. Nobody takes the journey by themselves. We all need somebody else. We all have friends, and we all have adversaries. And it's that process that changes us and allows us to become much more than we currently are today. And I believe that that's the basic monomyth theory, that all the stories that you collect around the globe fall into this basic pattern. And the end state of that pattern is the individual has changed. They have transformed. They've become better than they were, and they brought something back to their society. These people that love them and help them, and they bring that back for their benefit. And for the hero, it's the transformation. For the society, it's the boon. And that's the real goal of the hero's journey. If I may, I believe the best story, as always, is Harry Potter.
Okay.
That's a great place to start because, you know, here's this little kid living a dismal life with his extended family, and, you know, he's like a second-class citizen, and yet he's endowed with all these God-given abilities that he knows little about. You know, he may suspect them, but he hasn't emerged yet as a new person. And so you kind of see the call to adventure. And from an LDS point of view, you know, who can't look at Nephi from the Book of Mormon and say, wow, you know, there's a guy who had a call, and he had to go out and do great things from a point of view of having no experience, from starting from a very weak position, you know, a kid growing up in a rich man's home, to going back and doing really tough things. You know, just chipping into something that Carol Lynn said earlier, I don't think gender is as important as some of us like to think. I believe that women have the same sort of experience. They get called to higher things, too. They believe in accomplishment and achievement. You can't really isolate it out and say it's a male thing or not a female thing because it's just not true. Everybody has a call. Everybody wants to emerge into the world and be great. And I believe that's the start point. And, of course, one of the archetypes in this first stage is the herald, you know, a John the Baptist figure who comes along and says, you know, who is the big guy in Harry Potter that came and knocked the door over?
Hagrid.
Yeah, Hagrid. I mean, what a great character. You know, I mean, John the Baptist in the New Testament fits this role. He's just this wonderful, rough, unyielding figure come to make an announcement. And then, of course, usually, our hero probably doesn't feel up to the task. Usually our hero wants to say, this can't be me. You've made a mistake of some kind. And not always. This doesn't always happen, but frequently you shrink from the task because it's usually daunting.
Okay, so that's the first phase that often comes. Some of the language that you find in Campbell and other places is like you're in the ordinary world and somebody comes along to tell you about the special world or the, I can't remember, there was a couple other phrases that are basically there. You know, they tell you this other realm. So somehow or other, either they come along, like you say, in the terms of a herald. A lot of times it's this, you know, it's the stirrings within you that say there's more to this than what I'm getting at this level. I'm going to explore. You know, it can be a person. It can be just sort of a divine kick in the butt to move you off your normal comfort zone, right? So kind of thing. But then there is that fear level. So one of the great stories, obviously, and we've got to use it again in the middle of this story, is Jonah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, talk about your reluctant hero.
Exactly. Please, Carolyn, did you want to jump in there?
Oh, I was actually just clearing my throat, but as long as you've given me the space, let me just toss this in. Because I really want to invite everybody who's listening to see this not just as a literary thing or not just as some people are called, but this is actually pretty much the Mormon plan of salvation. And
no
what
kidding.
I want to want to toss in is that about a year ago I realized that one of the first things I wrote that had any traction at all fits so well with the hero's journey that I was astonished that I could map it right out there. And that's my little musical play, My Turn on Earth. Do you remember that?
You bet.
So for those who don't know this, it takes these five little people who are up in heaven, and they are having just the best time. The living here is heavenly. And then all of a sudden, they're told, you're going to be sent away. The call to adventure. And, oh, my gosh, no, we don't want to go. We're having a good time here. No, you must go. If you're going to become like Heavenly Father and Mother, the King and Queen of the kingdom here, you've got to go. Well, so the refusal of the call is played out for a while, and then they cross the threshold and come down to earth, and they're here. And then they go to the next step of the tests, the allies, the enemies, the dangers, all of that. And go through all of this stuff of mortality that develops and develops until we, for most of us, we are going to find one or more tremendous supreme ordeals where
right.
our very sense of who we are is going to be threatened. But just as is played out in that inmost cave, the point of it all is to claim our own divinity, that in spite of any other voice that's telling us to destroy ourselves or that we're not good enough, that we know who we are and we claim that divinity. And so getting through that supreme ordeal, then we have the reward. Oh, well, back in heaven, we've been told that if you're able to do this, and I set it up as a treasure hunt. And the treasure that you're looking for, you've got to bring that back because that'll help you become like Father and Mother in heaven are. So these little kids are on the treasure hunt. And as it develops, the just before our heroine Barbara is called back, she has to make this this decision. As she hears the voice calling her back, and then as she's moves across the stage, there are people who need the things that she's gathered. And she knows she's got something that the very best thing that there is on earth that she has to take back to Heavenly Father and Mother. But as she crosses the stage, somebody needs this, and she gives it away. Someone needs this, and she gives it away. someone needs the elder, and she gives it away. And there she is empty-handed. And then she hears the voice of her brother Christ saying, thank you for the gifts. They were exactly what you came to find on earth. And, of course, the elixir that they've been sent for is love. And that is what everybody has been sent to earth here to find. That is the elixir that cures all ills, and that is the one we have been sent to earth to find, to take back, that will make us like our Father and Mother in heaven.
Beautiful, beautiful.
I would like to add to that, if I could, Dan, very quickly, I promise.
Totally.
I grew up in very difficult circumstances, and I learned to read with comic books. Now, I wasn't going to disclose this, but that's how I started reading. And I associated the pictures with the words, and, you know, the rest is history. I'm doing great now. But the point is, I was deeply impressed by various mythologies and figures like Thor and Hercules. And they were both cast out of their version of heaven in order to complete certain deeds, you know, the 12 labors of Hercules, and bring back something to their heaven, you know, Olympus or wherever, to show that they were worthy of the blessings of being a son of God. And when I first was introduced to the church, I instantly understood what was going on because I read it as a kid. I just read it with a different set of clothes. Mm-hmm. You know, Hercules, Thor, the god of thunder and all that rah-rah. The truth is, it's still the same story. It's just disguised. I was always a little disappointed that at least Joseph Campbell could have examined a premortal existence or a life before this one, because most of the religions on the planet, not just ours, look at a premortal existence of some kind. You've got a billion people living in India, and they've been exposed to the idea that they might have lived before this day and age on the planet Earth. And so it just kind of surprised me it's not discussed, and just as Carolyn just introduced, yeah, it's all in the myth. You just got to read it. You got to find it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, very cool, guys. So you're cruising along, everything's good, and then you start to have this realization that there's more to it. It scares you. You may run. You may get on that ship and flee from go the opposite direction from Nineveh. But some things will come along that will convince you that you need to do that, and some of it will be a belly of the whale, and we'll deal with that in a second. So, Dave, I'm going to let you go ahead and kind of talk about, after that refusal of the call, what's a typical pattern begins to emerge?
I think it's typical to hit the threshold, and right around the threshold, you're probably going to find a mentor, or somebody's going to be at the crossroads, and they're going to assist you. So there you have an archetype there, you know, indicating, hey, look, here's your mission, here's your task in life, here's what you got to do. You know, Gandalf, it's going to show up. So you kind of say, I'm at the threshold because I'm leaving my old life, and here's this guy standing in front of me, my drill sergeant, telling me I got to do all this new stuff. And then there's usually some kind of divine aid. Boy, you know, in the Book of Mormon, here again, I can't help but wonder what they thought when they saw the Liahona. You know, they're in desperate straits. They've abandoned their society. They're out in the desert. And they're probably going to make a run for it, maybe down the Silk Trail to China. I don't know. Lehi's probably got all this in his head. What am I going to do now? Walks outside, and there's the divine aid at his feet, a compass. A compass that leaves messages. So in his case, he didn't get a mentor, but he got a way to receive messages. And I think that's like the chicken breaking out of the shell. We're going into the new world, and we don't know anything about it. And then, of course, as you described, the long journey begins. It's very difficult. This is the entry into the belly of the whale. I mean, we look at the Jaredites living in their barges for almost a year, just a couple of days past a year. You know, what a traumatic personal low point. What a time to feel the loss of the comforts of home, the comforts of companionship, you know, your ego that... You were the guy, you know, you were you are number one on campus. You're the most popular gal on campus, or you're the most, you know, you're the best football player, or you were the cheerleader that everybody loved, and now that's all gone. Now you're on the journey. And myself, as I emailed you, I'm quite humored because I frequently find myself in the belly of that whale, you know, kind of a time of depression. You just don't feel good about everything, and you're probably wondering, why in the world you put yourself on this journey?
Yep.
Very, very dark.
Oh, yeah.
Confusion, all the chaotic stuff that's going on below the surface. You know, when you're playing in the level of your ego, you know, that's the control center. I got it all here. And now all of a sudden you've let yourself go and you're into stuff that has not been pre-interpreted for you. Because that's the typical story of, you know, the early life is everyone's told you what everything means. And now you have to go into the fire itself, into the chaotic stuff yourself. And you have to.
Yeah, and even as you speak, I can hear the vulnerability. Even in your voice, I hear the vulnerability you feel that you didn't feel before the threshold. Before you passed out of that world into this difficult one, you didn't feel vulnerable, and now you do.
Right.
You're very vulnerable. You feel a lot of fear and difficulty ahead and on the road. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, Carolyn, did you want to jump in about the belly of the whale or the dark times?
Well, there's plenty that I've experienced on that level, and if you want me at some point in this conversation to tell something about how I have adapted this to for the benefit of our gay brothers and sisters, their belly of the whale, their supreme ordeal, is for many of them very, very huge, and many of them don't get out of it because the shadow that is there saying to them, you are not worthy of life. Take this sword and destroy yourself before you shame your family, before you shame your church and lose your salvation. As we know, many of our gay brothers and sisters in the belly of the whale, in this supreme ordeal, have been overwhelmed by the negative things that we have said to them and about them, so that they have not had the strength to emerge. And that's one reason I think that this whole path, as it's laid out for them, can be so hopeful to make that kind of suffering be meaningful.
So powerful.
And I feel it a terrible loss to all of us. To lose a human life when you're in the belly of the whale is a true loss. You want to say to that person, don't give up. Continue. Fight through. You know, I'm a soldier. Fight through. Hang in there. There is an exit. It will happen. Stay with it. Don't quit. And, you know, you just don't want them to give up on whatever it is. You know, it's just not that important. Hang in there. You will emerge at the other side. The Jaredite barges did land. And I'm sure they came out and were just kissing Mother Earth for all their worth. I'm sure after a whole year of traveling, they didn't think they'd ever get anywhere.
Sure. And for those among us, like many of our gay brothers and sisters, our responsibility also is to give them, before they even have to enter this darkest time, to give them for their knapsack, so they have something when they are in this dark, dark place, that they remember not only the terrible, condemning words that they have heard, but they remember our words that are filled with light and love and saying to them, you are valuable. There is nothing flawed about who you are. We have got to give that to them so that they're better equipped when they are in that supreme ordeal.
Right, because one of the stages in the first threshold is that you will have allies appear, and you, as well as the enemies. So,
right.
What is it? Tests, allies, and enemies is usually kind of talked about in this stage. And so, yeah, those messages that you have, and so, in some ways, you know, when Jim, Jim Fowler talks about stages of faith. He says it's much more difficult for somebody who wasn't raised with a solid mythos, with a solid sense of who they were, or that the world made sense or something like that, because you sort of need that tether when you're in this dark, you know, confusing, pulling apart and reconstructing phase that, you know, he calls stage four, emerging into stage five. You sort of need that sense of a home and a center of gravity and things that's so important. And so what you're saying here, I tell me if I'm wrong, is hopefully those messages of love, of worth, and all those things are so part of you that when you are in this most difficult time, you'll feel those little messages come up.
Absolutely. But sadly, for many of them, the center, the primary story that they have been, that I'm speaking now specifically of our gay brothers and sisters.
Right.
The heaviest, most often repeated story about who they are that has been given to them again and again is one of absolute self-loathing. And so they have to bring with them through this journey into this dark, dark cave something that is stronger than those awful images and words that they have heard. And I think the best thing that we can give to them is an assurance that they will have with them inside that darkness, that the light that is in them will not go out. And
yes.
that indeed, as I just heard in one of your recent podcasts, Dan, the kingdom of God is within you. I think that's the best thing to remember when anybody is in the supreme ordeal, in the belly of the whale, in the dark night of the soul, that the kingdom of God is within us. And we can listen to the truer voices that come from within us, that ask us to claim life and that show us the light that is within us and that beckons us to follow.
Yes, thank you. One thing, too, about these bellies of the whale, no one can expect that these are short-term adventures, years, decades sometimes for some of these. And so hopefully with the allies, with the friends that come along, with the letters from home, meaning from God or from the universe that says you're divine, hopefully those get there. Are you a fan of the It Gets Better message, Carolyn, I guess, for the GLBT? I mean, that seems to me to be sort of these love letters and
ways
ahead.
I think that's a great contribution, sure. And you know, Dan, the word ally, when you were emphasizing the word ally, that's often a word that is used as, you know, for
right,
the
a straight, straight ally, yeah.
Yeah.
I something that helps me, and you know, it's slightly off topic, but I go out and seek love. If I have a low point in my life, I have some coping mechanisms that I developed through the years. You know, I like to learn new things, but that always helps me snap out of it. But if I hit a low point, I go find somebody who will extend themselves in love towards me. And, you know, even on the hero's journey, you find love because it's the fuel that gets you through the transformation. But you know, if you really are in the belly of that whale, and it looks like it's a long duration, you got to get a coping mechanism. You've got to go out and find love. It may not come to you, then you have to go out and get it. And I say that generically to anybody who's listening, that anybody out there, whatever they're struggling with, hey, go find an ally. Go find a friend. Go find somebody who doesn't care about whatever that issue is and just loves you for who you are. And you'll find great happiness. You just have to do it. You can't quit the journey. You've got to find out what's in it for you. Quitting the journey is never a good solution.
And if I remember the lit on this, it's not till you commit to past the threshold that typically they will say that the ally or the mentor will arise, though. True, right?
You're deeply in the new world. You're deeply in the desert before somebody comes out there and discovers you. Really, you don't get that until you've proven you've left the old world behind.
Right. that you're committed on the path. Yeah. Now, one of the interesting things, Carolyn, you talked about the cave just as you were talking about the My Turn on Earth things. And so we've been talking about this general belly of the whale times of confusion and not really having a map and things like that. At some point, the language of an old self dying in order to have a new self being reborn, there's this really, you know, there's lots of different things that can be at play in a belly way, but generally there's a task or something that is the true life and death struggle. And one of the pieces, I think it's in the Vogler 12 steps there, is one of his stages is the approach. And this is like the idea of you're now ready to get into this innermost cave, this innermost battle for your very existence, you know, the old self, the new self in battle. And you often will, that's when you'll hit the biggest setbacks, because you'll realize that entire new ideas are needed. You know, you need to come at things from a different angle and whatnot. Do you guys have any, am I remembering that right?
I just think it's further down the journey, Dan. I do. I think that does happen, but I think it's further in the journey. I think you have some experiences prior to having those conflicts that cause you to solidify your personality. I think you've got to find love before that moment. You've got to find somebody who believes in you and they don't care. They love you. They support you. And because of that, you suddenly realize, I can make it. I can be this new person. I can become. And there's a few other people you've got to meet along the way, too. You've got to be able to determine a person's loyalty. So you meet somebody who you don't know which side of the fence they're on. And you got to figure that out. And sometimes it's the good guy, and sometimes it's the bad guy. But you kind of got to decide that out before you go to that final conflict. And sometimes it's in the final conflict you make those discoveries. So I believe, I'm just, my point of view anyhow, I just believe that you got to push along the journey, and you've got to kind of build the new social life first, and then confront the big thing.
Okay.
And then you're done. Then you've
I'm
really
moving
figured
too fast
it out.
To the cave. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Those sound like good choices. Sometimes life doesn't hand them to us in that, maybe quite that
clear. Level. Yeah. True.
As I'm remembering reading about the approach to the inmost cave is seeing in the distance the place that you want to get to, seeing beyond where you can kind of glimpse happiness and peace, but then you learn that the only way to get there is to go through
it,
the darkest place, to go through the supreme ordeal, that you can't go around it, that you have to go through it.
Yeah, it takes a lot of courage. And hopefully, like you say, Dave, you've got the friends, the allies, that sense of love. You know, you've readied yourself for the journey. And of course, we're never in a steady progression. It's a few steps ahead and a big tumble back here and there, or a body blow, or something comes out of there, and we have to muster our courage and our energy and things like that. But eventually, to get this full integration, and again, we're talking with Campbell, we're in the Carl Jung sort of stuff. It's like it's harmonizing these deeper things with the outer world, the full integration. Of a person has to not just be head and what I can think and what I can control, but this marriage between the primordial powers.
Yeah, if it helps a little bit, I think you need the dynamic tension of opposition. You got to have a choice. The choice isn't quit or go forward. The choice is, who am I going to be? Am I going to be a good guy or a bad guy? And that you're faced with that choice. And if you don't have that dynamic tension, you're not really moving forward. You've got to have a little bit of difficulty and set, an Adam and Eve moment, if you will. You know, Eve has got to accept her responsibility. Adam's got to accept his responsibility. And they have to come into some sort of agreement inside that tension circle. This is going to work. We can make this work despite our difficulties. And boom, then they go deep. So unless you have that challenge before you go right to the final conflict. You're really not at the final conflict yet. Got to have it.
And, you know, these terms are all dramatic terms that we that we insist upon. When we go to a movie, if there's not conflict, if there's not hard choices to be made, we feel cheated. We want our money back.
Right, right.
We go.
That's a popcorn movie rather than a.
Well, yeah. We go there to sit in a safe place and watch all of this drama play out in front of us, and we can probably see more clearly than the characters can see just what's going on. But those are the life values that make it interesting and that give us a payoff. If we don't get a payoff when we leave that theater, we really feel cheated. And so in life, if we don't get the payoff of having done the big thing, even though we didn't want to, we probably will feel cheated.
Yeah.
We came here for the big ride, I believe.
Yeah, I want to say something about something Carolyn said a little earlier about in the gay and lesbian movement that people have said harmful and ugly things. And during this purification or this difficult period, those individuals are unmasked for what they really are. Because if I truly, you know, God is love, and if I'm tracking on that in my life, I'm not going to say hurtful things to my brother or my sister. And the reason why is God is love. I should be like God. God is love. I should have loving comments. And this gets unmasked during the difficulty. You know, you acted loyal, but you really weren't. You know? And the guy who might have been kind of tough on me and expected a lot and sought to my well-being, but he was rough around the edges, you know, Hagrid types, you realize, wait a minute, I thought he was the bad guy because he looked so rough. And you realize, hey, he was always sticking up for me. He never thought that was something that they should be concerned about. And so during the ordeal, part of it is unmasking the trickster, you know, the adversary, the guy who looks right, but when you boil it down to it, he's not on my side after all. It was a trip.
I'm taking back the personal power.
Awesome. Great. Very good. Well, Dave, why don't you take us through right up into the return? What are some of the other features that are often at play as you move towards the big confrontations of the innermost cave and things?
Thank you. And I think one of the key people or key archetypes is something is going to be there to tempt you. Someone or something is going to desire that you leave your quest. They're going to offer you something you think you should have. I mean, there's always an opportunity out there that you imagine is better than the one you're living.
Yeah.
You know? I'm sure that you would be tempted if CBS called, you know, Dan Witherspoon tonight and said, hey, look, we'd like to pay $1 million, move you to San Diego, and you can live in a big mansion. At least for a few minutes, you might be tempted. You have to admit it. And then you remember, like you said in another podcast, that you found your bliss and you're going to follow it, and here it is. And so we're all going to have to face that position. Somebody's going to offer me something. It's going to look good, but it's going to take me away from what I truly desire, that fulfillment I seek.
Now, you've just made the Wayne's World movie into an archetypal thing with that, you know, the cable news show that gets net goes big and loses its soul. So thank you for that.
I'm sure there are people out there, too, who are offering Carolyn the same thing. You know, if you just quit broadcasting the message of love, we'll give you all this other stuff. We'll do another movie or whatever you think you might want. If you just leave your message alone and, you know, let hate run this little program, you can have everything else. You realize that, yeah, it's there. I face it every day. I think everybody faces it from time to time. I believe that there's a most confrontations don't start off as thermonuclear war. I think most confrontations start off kind of small. And usually our hero is intimidated by the threat. You know, in Star Wars saga, you had the black and red guy, I can't remember his name, but, you know, he takes on the two Jedis, but he's not really the bad guy. You know, the bad guy's the Emperor. And so frequently I think our hero meets somebody along the way that they must vanquish in order to qualify for the larger conflict.
Right.
Maybe that's not always true, but you see it in so many occasions that you realize, hey, here's the big problem. What comes to mind, by the way, is, you know, the Nephites are trying to make it to America, and Laman and Lemuel are hard to deal with, but they're not impossible. But when they finally get out to sea, they become impossible. You know, they tie up Nephi, they threaten to throw the parents overboard. It's very, very uncomfortable. I'm sure that they've got their wives there, and they're making them miserable. And so, like, there's an escalation process is what I'm getting to. And so it requires a lot of commitment. You have to stay to the end. You got to go the distance. And this is not always easy. And you're not in the belly of the whale. That might have prepared you for endurance and stamina in a fight, but you have to be in the fight for a long time and be able to finish what you came to do. And in a way, that might end the conflict. In other words, you get your boon, you finally achieve your fulfillment and your goal in life, whatever it is, but in the process, it takes away your life. You know, Joseph Campbell there finally got to give his little, you know, monomyth on the Bill Moyers interviews, and then he dies right afterwards. You know, you want to talk about a guy living the hero's journey. He literally got the boon at the end. You know, he got the international fame, and he got his message out just as he was dying. So he never really saw the results. He'll never hear this conversation. He'll not be a part of it. And the Campbell Foundation and all that is all because of him. But in many journeys, and I'm here at Army Casualty, I see the end state. You know, I see the widow and the children, and we're doing benefits for them and trying to help them put their lives back together because their warrior completed his journey. And it's very emotional and it's very moving. And the boon that he brought back for all of us is freedom, so that we could have a podcast and talk about anything we want to talk about.
Right. May I add to that also that when I remember that this journey is not just an outward journey, the most significant part of it is an inner journey, then I think we can reassess what Joseph Campbell surely felt tremendous satisfaction all along the way, and that the fallen warriors very likely had every opportunity, not on the physical battlefield. And there's a statement that my former husband Gerald used to like to say, that the most important battles are the ones that are fought on the field of consciousness.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's an inward thing. And the hero's journey is essentially an inward journey. So on whatever physical ground we are, we all can begin and complete, with a lot of variables, of course, that hero's journey.
Okay, so you're in the life and death battle. You've succeeded. You have these moments of triumph and whatnot, but the journey isn't complete. What's next?
You know, there is always the return. Sometimes the return kind of isn't what you think it is. I'm always remembering my favorite Book of Mormon character, Abinadi. He comes in to give a message, and they say, we're not going to listen to your messages. Off with this fellow's head, so to speak. They attempt to take him, and they cannot take him. He has divine powers upon him. And he delivers his message. And then when he's done delivering the message, of course, we know the rest of the story. They go out and kill him. They burn him to death. And he makes his prophecies. And we have the Book of Mormon today because of Abinadi. His boldness and his testimony and his belief and his strength of character launched a young man by the name of Alma. And he saw this, and he saw what true character was, and he saw what the hero's journey was all about. So in a way, sometimes the hero's journey ends for one, and it begins for another. And it began there for Alma just as it ended for Abinadi. In most cases, though, you think of the missionary coming home. You know, his journey's over. He went, you know, the sister missionary worked in some foreign country under deplorable conditions. She smiled. She was rejected. She tried everything she could do to bring people closer to whatever truth they had at the time. and yet it's time to come home. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult for a sister missionary or an elder to come home off his mission and bring back his gifts. But that's the return, and it does happen. We all have to end the journey. And we sit around and we pine away and wish we could go again, and we look for the next journey.
Carolyn, your book was very powerful on the return phase.
Yeah. And, you know, tomorrow I'm getting on an airplane to go to Salt Lake to speak at the International Conference of Affirmation, which, for those who don't know, is the organization for gay and lesbian Mormon people. And their president, Randall Thacker, asked if I would speak Saturday morning on the hero's journey of the gay and lesbian Mormon. And I feel it is so important, but all of the steps of this journey are so important to impress and to offer our gay brothers and sisters. But this is a very tricky one that I think is so important. This road back where the wise one says, now that you have gotten through the worst of all of this journey, now's the time you got to take the road back, go back home. And what? I left there. I left the Mormon tribe because they threw me out or because they didn't want me the way I was or whatever. But it is an insistence. You must go back because your learning is not just for yourself. All you have learned is for them as well. And so they have to go through the next step, which is resurrection. They have to be cleansed, purified. And here comes the word forgiveness. The hero has to forgive whomever, whatever he, she has to forgive in order to be purified. And this is sometimes a very big thing to ask of our gay people, for all of the damage that has been done to them. And yet, it must happen. Jesus was absolutely clear on this, forgiving everybody for everything. And this is the only way, really, that you can also take back your own personal power and not squander it with resentment and blame. So to go through this process of forgiving whomever it was that hurt you, forgiving the institution, if that is what needs to happen, not necessarily for their sake, but for your own sake, then, according to Campbell, you have truly found the elixir, which is love. And then you can return to the tribe sharing that elixir, saying, I may or I may not stay here, but I am here at this moment. I am here to show you who I am. I am here to shine in front of you and to share with you everything that I have learned and what I have been blessed with as I found the reward. It is here for you now to see. And that's how the Mormon tribe is going to be enriched, by being able to view our returning or visiting gay brothers and sisters and see them more purely for who they really are.
And you do talk about there still will be many that don't get you in things, but you'll see it in the eyes of so-and-so. And thank you for coming and being a teacher for us. And it was almost like a, you know, you don't expect the hero's return, you know, in terms of triumphant parades, but yet you will capture that attention of some.
Right. And in my little book, at the very end, I suggest that as the heroes come back to the tribe, and they come back having made different choices. Some will be in relationship with one another. Some will have married in a traditional way, and the marriage didn't last. But they have handled it kindly and heroically and with love. Some may have been in a traditional marriage and choose to stay there, and can also do that with integrity and with love and shining as a hero. Some may choose a path of celibacy, or some may look for a relationship and not find it. And they, too, are heroes and can shine and serve in all of the ways that, that life brings them the opportunity. So it doesn't really matter as much which physical path you're choosing here, but what your inner path is, and that you do find the elixir of love and be able to share it with everyone. I'm thrilled that I get to give this vision to my gay brothers and sisters. I'm really thrilled at that.
We're grateful for that. Dave, anything else on the return? And then I want to just jump out of the... I just want to kind of apply it to Mormonism more generally after
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I love the mastery at the end of a journey. You have accomplished great tasks and works in more than one world. You have gone through some kind of ordeal. You have made the sacrifice. You have departed from your own self, and now you're the new person. New confidence, new abilities, and you bring that mastery back to your world. So in a really a plain text way, and I thought resurrection is a great term, by completing the hero's journey, you bring back that mastery in yourself for your society, but you feel great. You've accomplished great things, and you have a great deal of confidence. And so it really prepares you for your next journey. You know, you get through the task, you accomplish your deed, you come back to your society as a new person, and then, boom, when the time comes, you go on your next journey, but now you know you can make it. You suffered through it, now you can know you can do the next one. It's a great reward.
Let's shift this a little bit. Let's really focus here where we are with Mormon Matters, with the listenership that kind of comes to these Facebook groups, these blogs. Everyone here, in some ways, I think it's safe to say, who listens to this podcast has sort of said, the ordinary world isn't quite cutting it the way that everything's been interpreted for me. I know that there's something more going on and things like that. And so they've begun a journey. Sometimes it was thrust upon them through wild facts that came across their way. Sometimes it was a traumatic experience. But for some reason, they've been called to journey into the deeper, more chaotic realms. So I think we can agree with all that. And then there's Dave and Carolyn and me here as the conversationists in this thing, who in some ways I think we've certainly been on these journeys for a long, long time. We've been exploring, you know, the inner conflicts, and we've been putting things together and kind of having to do our own interpretations and stuff. And in some ways, by being public figures, we are doing this return path to where we're trying to model shiny selves. I love that term of yours, Carolyn. We're trying in some ways to say, you know, here's where I am. I'm committed to you. I love you. I forgive you. I'm ready to be part of this community. And yet there's a level of confidence that, you know, even if we were rejected or whatnot within that community, that we're still centered. We've accomplished certain tasks and things. And of course, none of us would ever claim that we're done. None of us claim that we're finished characters. Dave says there's always a new journey to go on, and that's absolutely the truth. So I just want to kind of get a sense from you two. I think I've talked enough on the podcasts in the past to sort of how I go about this. What were key moments for each of you when you kind of just said, okay, from my life experiences, from the battles I fought and things like that, I still wanted to choose Mormonism, and I'm okay being an outlier. I'm okay being somebody on an edge that I know. Is it the fact that some people recognize you as a person with some wisdom or something like that, or is it just the confidence that came about? Carolyn, would you go first on this? I mean, you're out there, you're talking about Mormonism left and right, and it's clear from pretty much everybody around you that they know Carolyn's going to say something really interesting. Some of them are going to be afraid of what you say. Some of them are going to like what you say. How is it that you've gained the confidence, you know, to be a Mormon in that full committed way as the returning hero, to whatever degree you'd want to call yourself that?
Yeah, well, boy, that is such a rich interesting question, Dan. I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say.
Nice.
Well, certainly my first step, the ordinary world, was this safe, warm Mormon place, fourth generation Mormon.
Right.
I grew up, went to BY High School, Provo, Utah. I did all the right things. Honestly, I was the best little Mormon girl in the world. And the call to adventure, I guess. Well, I always had a real unrest about women's issues.
Okay.
But my real call to adventure was one that I could not avoid, where my world came crashing down around my feet when I discovered that my marriage journey with my husband was not what I thought it was, and that he had not been cured from this homosexuality that we had discussed during our engagement period. That immediately thrust me onto a new frontier, and all of my signposts essentially were gone. I had to look down and pick up the pieces: God, church, myself, the idea of marriage, everything I had been taught, everything I was just up for grabs on the floor. And so, and certainly it was a cyclical, round and about journey, as mm-hmm. well as maybe a straightforward one of just tentatively taking step after step and finding some ways to feel that I'm still a part of the Mormon tribe, wanting to mm-hmm. be part of the Mormon tribe, sometimes saying, whoa, I don't belong here. No
right.
way. And sort of maybe acting out a little modern-day miracle of not being tossed out of the tribe for being more radical than a lot of people who have been tossed out, and also making a decision that while I truly do see life itself and the whole human tribe as much, much larger than the Mormon tribe,
right,
but making a very personal decision that this is my tribe. And if God is love, this is where I find a lot of God, because I find a lot of love. And maybe the thing that saves me, that might not work for other people, is that somehow or other I have been or developed a position where I can be a part of creating more love in those areas where I personally judge, and with whose else judgment could I judge but my own, where I judge that love is not yet there. And because life has called me to serve the gay community in some very large ways, that I'm really so honored to be able to have that position. And because I also feel called to and have been able to do a lot to increase our love for the concept of the female,
right,
divine and human. Those are the ways that life has called me to want to try to shape my own tribe, which is a wonderful part of God's larger tribe, which is the whole human family, in a way where we all can experience a warmer tribe, a community where we support each other in the various journeys that each of us take. And I realize that that it's a very individual thing for people like me who are dealing. And then, I'm sorry, not hyperventilating, but dealing with very, very profoundly painful, difficult topics. of gender issues, of historical kinds of issues. I fully understand that many people who deal with the same kinds of issues that have come up for me make a choice to leave the Mormon tribe, that they are called on a hero's journey that takes them in a different direction. And I will not in any way discount the validity of where they are called to be. For me, I'm grateful that I have been able not just to be tolerated, but to be really appreciated. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke in sacrament meeting here, and our theme was smoothing the path of others. And the bishop actually asked me to tell the story of how I smoothed the path for my former husband. I had not been asked to tell that story in an official church meeting like that, which shows the distance that we have come mm-hmm. and that I've been able to contribute to on that issue. So I'm grateful for the place that I have in the tribe, and I do have a strong commitment to give to the tribe and to take from the tribe the beautiful things that are there. And I honor everybody who feels likewise or those who feel that they are called elsewhere.
Thank you very much. Now, one of the things that we did talk about earlier is part of this heroes slaying the innermost cave and things like that is the discovery of perhaps, we talked about it sometimes in terms of your own divinity or et cetera, but the core of love, of connection. And I think what you've said there, in some ways you could almost like, you know, if you were to give in a general authority talk, you know, kind of thing, you'd say the thing that will be the most successful is if you're interacting with people who don't get you or not, that they just see that you're all about love. You know, in other words, that's the thing you accomplish on the hero's journey is you become a being who's a loving being. And when that's seen versus the person that still is angry or still is, lashing out or whatever it is, mm-hmm. I think that's been a big secret for you, it sounded like, as well as that's kind of a, if you wanted to take a lesson and say it more discreetly.
Mm. No, I appreciate that, Dan. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, all about it. Dave, you, I guess in some ways, maybe as a convert, you have a little bit different way to do. You came in sort of weird, and it's okay. You were granted a pass in some ways that you had different perspectives informing you. And it sounds like you, when you first even encountered Mormonism, you were already aware of the hero's journey. Or at least you were aware to it, so you just saw it all over in Mormonism to begin with. So in some ways, it was a really easy language for you, right? Mormonism.
Yeah, it was an amazingly easy language, but I also faced a great deal of rejection even from within the church, and you kind of just deal with it because when you feel like you're on good ground, you stay on good ground. And for me, that's the end state of the hero's journey. For me, is that I know for myself where I need to stand. Therefore, I don't need to look down on my fellow man or wonder about their journey or wonder why they're doing what they're doing, because I have to be certain about my ground. And it's a very comfortable place to be, despite affliction, despite rejection and difficulties. I just dealt with it, and I was happy to do so. Happy to do so, and that's the end state for the hero's journey for me, is that I feel confident in who I am and what I'm doing. And a lot of people don't like that. And I look at them and I extend as much, warmth and charity as I can and hope that one day they come around and see the larger picture. Really, I do. I love life. I just love it, Dan. And I want to spread the zeal for living to everybody so that they can all have great experiences like I've had.
Yeah, and there... But again, you didn't arrive fully formed, right? There was those dark times that probably happened within the church too. Or did you feel like you'd kind of found that ground even before you really engaged Mormonism daily?
I can honestly say this. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know where I was along the path, and that I had a lot of dark days to live, both before I got baptized and after I was baptized. Many dark days, many difficulties. I faced that adversity with as much courage as I could muster, because I believed that it was worth the trial. I knew that long before I was a member of the church. It was later that it sort of came into a language that I could use, and that's what Campbell bequeathed to me, is the language that explains what's happening to all of us.
Yeah, yeah, terrific. Now, I guess I want to ask one more thing about, well, there was, Dave, often when you were talking, you know, at first we started with Harry Potter and things like that, but you would go right to Nephi and Abinadi, and you talked the Atonement and pre-earth life and all that stuff. And this came very naturally to you. As, does the historicity of those things matter to you? Because a Campbell would probably come along and say, those are just great stories that fit this pattern. It doesn't matter whether they're historically true or not. And so as I listened to you here, and these came so easy, I could see you'd have a very easy time at church, because no one would be aware that you might entertain the fact that these may not be literal, that they may be more of an archetypal thing going on, that whatever the revelatory process of Joseph Smith was, he may have been tuning into archetypes rather than historical an account, something like that. Does that make any sense? Tell me
oh,
how.
Absolutely. You know, I admit to you and the audience that I embellish my own stories as I tell them. I tell many stories. I had a missionary companion that was a wonderful storyteller, and you know, I value this trait about myself. I love story. I tell stories. And I do slightly embellish in my own case. I try not to, of course, but we all want to tell the world from our glorious perspective. And you know, it happens. And I don't deny that there could be something in the scriptures that is maybe exaggerated or embellished, but I really believe those experiences in the Book of Mormon. There's a couple of places in there that just sound too personal for them not to be actual experiences. You know, one of the great ones is at the end of the second book of Nephi, and you and I shall stand face to face before his bar. You know, that's a little too personal. Enos, I kneeled down before my maker. You know, I've done that. I've kneeled down before my maker. And I'm just saying that if I've experienced it, it's probably real. I mean, I'm a 32 and I'm reading how just give it a chance. Plant the seed, just desire to believe. And when I was there in the moment, I was like that too. I had never read the Book of Mormon. And when I discovered it in there, much like the Campbell event, it kind of gave me a language and a place and a reference that I could share with my buddies. But the reality is, I've experienced some of those things myself, therefore I think they're real.
They're historical, but they're real.
Historically real. I believe a man named Enos.
Okay. Okay.
Was in the woods as a hunter, and I believe he hit his knees, and he poured out his voice to the Lord, and the Lord heard him and responded. I believe that happened.
So that wouldn't be mythic the way you might, where Campbell would say, Jesus' three temptations, Buddha's three temptations, basically archetypal sorts of things.
I just think that some things are real. And Buddha's temptations were fear and desire. And those are not the temptations that the Messiah experienced prior to his ministry. And so, yeah, there's probably a lot of dust in the air. There's probably a lot of mud in the water. And you got to wonder what's real and what's not real. But frankly, I just feel too close to some of these things to say that they weren't real. And I just don't think they're myth. And I do know Campbell would say, yeah, Jesus is a myth, and the Garden of Eden is a myth, and the Book of Mormon is a myth, and the patterns are there. I just think it's the original.
Okay, so that absolutely would help you negotiate Mormonism. Carolyn, are you comfortable a little bit less with a tie to historicity and a much more Campbellite, you know, hey, those barges, yeah, that works great. That's a great motif, but you know, I'm not sure that those had to happen.
I don't need to have everything pinned down like that. and I'm open to, you know, to whatever is real on a physical level, whatever might be even more real on an inner dimension or archetypal dimension. I don't spend much time worrying about that.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't either. And I'm able to say things, I think, that come out a little bit like Dave. I mean, maybe not quite as, you know, he walked out and there was a compass there, but I love the motif of a Liahona, you know. And when he talked about the barges, I don't think I've ever used the barges, but now I will, you know, without any worry about whether they were actual events. But I can see that they fit in this larger story, which for me is again about that, you know, whatever the hero's journey is for me, it's a personal journey. Obviously there's sociality and there's friends and different things. And, you know, like you said, Dave, earlier, you know, Campbell said, you know, the best way you can contribute to the world is to be your most authentic, biggest, best self. You know, obviously within Mormonism and things like that, but I have not played much with them being literally true in a long time, and yet I'm quite comfortable talking about them as if they are when I'm at church. I don't know. I don't even know what I was trying to go for there, but just kind of, I guess, disclosure. But it was interesting to hear you that you landed there, Dave.
I appreciate that, Dan, and I'm very comfortable with my faith and my beliefs, and I'm also extremely comfortable, like Carolyn had said, these things guide my life. And I apply them.
Too. Yeah, they're my favorite.
Yeah, I
things.
Apply them so much that they're like, it's a fluent language to me today. I didn't start out that way, of course. But, you know, I'm extremely grateful for all that I've been given, and I can't wait for more. It's just, you know, please give me more. When I emailed you, you know, once I found the truth, I've been gorging myself on it ever since. And that's really, I can't wait for more. I just can't imagine what's around the corner for us in the church. And in the future, it's going to be great.
And Dan, on the other hand, I'm not saying, oh, I want more, I want more. I'm trying to say, look, I've had enough supreme ordeals. I think I would just like a little peace now between here and the rest of the journey. But, you know, whatever's there is going to be there. And I'm with it.
Yes, yes. Well, neat, guys. Well, thank you for this conversation. I've really enjoyed it. I will link to some things that are, like, for instance, I'll link to the PBS, you know, I think it was the first episode, which is the Hero with a Thousand Faces, Hero's Journey, Campbell Moyers thing. And then there's a few other things that are online that kind of distill them in 10-minute bites and things like that. So I'll do that to sort of give a more of a, here's some categories, here's some language and things like that, and see a structure. So I'll link to all those different things for you. Carolyn and Dave, I hope you guys will, you know, come to the blog. I'll email you or something if I don't see you responding to something. But are you both willing to engage people a little bit about Campbell? And especially, I think the Mormon, you know, how does this connect with what we're going through as Mormons when we find ourselves in the midst of a more complicated story than the literal one, the one that, you know, got us through primary and perhaps through young men's, young women's, and, you know, and then we've been kind of taught that you've now mastered it all, and now it's endure to the end, and now we're realizing, man, there's a lot more to life than that, and I've got a lot more to do, and so
you think too much.
I can't help it.
It means you've got to keep doing these podcasts for time and all eternity. Because you will never run out of wonderful thoughts and wonderful things to think about, for which, by the way, I am very grateful, Dan. I love you, and I celebrate your being.
Well, thank you, and I love you. And Carolyn, I love to, I mean, not, I don't want to say it to embarrass you or anything like that, but thank you for donating. I mean, you are a great friend to this podcast, not only.
Oh, well, yeah, I went on. I became a monthly subscriber, didn't
you?
I?
Did.
Yes,
you,
I did.
You
and
did.
As they always say on PBS, this is brought to you by viewers like you, listeners
awesome.
Like me, and like you. So everybody, take this moment to go to your computer and you sign up for whatever small amount or larger amount you feel that you can to support Dan's most excellent work.
Thank you. I do a pitch at the end, and that I didn't expect you to actually do that for me. So thank
you. Well,
now
you don't have to.
No, I don't. But thank you for that. But no, you're just great. So thank you for being on, Dave. Thank you for introducing yourselves to our group and for calling this topic forth from all the possibilities that we could have done. I'm thrilled that we could introduce Campbell and the hero's journey a bit.
Thanks, Dan.
Good to be with you, Dave.
Take care, Carolyn.
Yes, you too.
Take care, you guys, and I'll just say, cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.